I want to look at Esther Perek Aleph. The Devarim's don't have Esther. And you can have Esther. Okay, I expect everybody here to have the text open if you either have a Tanakh or a computer. If not, you have two Tanakhs here. Would everybody here agree that from the evidence I posed to you last class, that Ahasuerus is either Artaxerxes the First or Xerxes the First? Nothing else fits the data. I know one of you kept on hacking me that there could be two Ahasuerus's in Tanakh. I can't disagree. Right? Question?
Sorry, I'm really quick. You said you weren't going to be here on Tuesday.
I don't know for sure if I'm about Tuesday. Okay. I have jury duty. They said to call back Monday night in order to determine whether it actually is on or not. So I'll leave some kind of a message, you know, on canvas as a big one. I'll know Monday night.
Thank you. If you're not in the first class, can we assume
that people here in the second class? That's probably true. And they make the third class, which is at noon, you know, for a jet early or something.
That's
good.
Likely.
Ahasuerus is separate people. Because we're saying there was a title. And if
it's
Spencer or three
different books. No, I don't think so. No, Ahasuerus is so close to Artaxerxes that that's the name. What's his name? Two Pesachim in a row they mention Persian King of Ahasuerus, and the next book it mentions Artaxerxes.
You don't believe that Ahasuerus is a type like Mara?
No, I don't think so.
Why does Aristotle translate it as the Ahasuerus?
It says who Ahasuerus maybe?
Yeah, okay. It says that it's Ahasuerus. He is the Ahasuerus who reigns on.
Yeah, because they said what they want. But what the Persians did was let the Greeks, what the British do, the French do, the 1200s, the Georgians,
and
the
become king.
That's
true.
What could be is that Ahasuerus had a different name before he became king. When you become king, many countries do change their names. By the way, each paro had a regular name. Paro was Ho, Northern. This part was probably Paro Ramses. Isn't moving. Okay, so probably if that's true, it's very possible that your name was Jim, and then when you became king, you took on a fancy name like popes do, like
hero.
You know, nothing wrong with that. Okay, so okay, so the data before us that I talked about last class is either the fourth king, fourth battle of Marathon, or the fifth king, Ezra and Nehemiah. Okay. Now, why would I think that Ahasuerus should be Xerxes more than Artaxerxes? Okay, you see the last time that Ahasuerus is mentioned in Megillas Esther?
Yeah, what about
Dariush?
If we say it was Xerxes the First, you take his son.
Well, the Ahasuerus in Sefer Daniel has a son named Dariush.
Shouldn't that make sense more of
I think so, especially since there's a guy named Ahasuerus who's mentioned in the Book of Ezra. I think I'm disagreeing chronologically with the Gemara that says that Ahasuerus was before Cyrus. Right? I'm disagreeing with it historically by saying, to just say Gemara's wrong historically. I think that the Gemara does not need to be taken as a historical delineation of when Ahasuerus lived. Rather, what the Gemara is noticing, which is how we're going to read Perek Aleph now, is that the Jews living at the time of Ahasuerus are delinquent in something where there is an ultimate truth that comes out of what Ahasuerus was saying in the Gemara, namely that the Jews are stuck here in Persia, they're not going back to Israel. The Gemara makes that delineation anachronistically. I hope you're getting this. Okay? Remember the delineation? He said, well, Nebuchadnezzar ruled 45 years, that's correct. Belshazzar ruled, his son ruled 23 years, that is correct. I'm the king after Belshazzar. That is very incorrect. The king after Belshazzar was, look at the list, Cyrus.
So the Gemara is not making a historical claim?
I think it's not making a historical claim. I think if you take the entire Gemara in its entirety, with A, Ahasuerus wearing the big day kimono, drinking from the cane of the Beis HaMikdash, right? The author of Esther using all these words that harp on, that only are only used in Tanakh to describe the Mishkan and Sefer Shmos and the Beis HaMikdash and Sefer Melachim. A little bit to Sefer Yechezkel, right? And the Gemara noticing that, what are all these Sheneyim doing in Persia? Shouldn't they be in Israel now? Right? Well, Yechezkel speaks as if though the only reason why a Jew would remain in Chutz La'aretz is because someone chained us to a slave ship and took us someplace else. And we're taking every waking hour trying to get back to Israel.
We know that that's not true, though.
Yeah, this book is telling us why it's not true.
Okay, I'm interested to know that, Drew.
This book is that's the hidden message of Megillat Esther. That's what I think the Gemara meant when it said, Esther min ha-Torah minayin, v'anochi aster aster panai mikem b'yavadu. I'll hide my face from you. That is manifest in pshat by God's name not appearing in the story. But there's a much deeper meaning to what that Gemara means. There's a hidden message to this book. The message is not, bad guy means us harm, we're in danger, saved at the last minute by clever machinations, let's eat. That's not what's happening here. Much deeper than this. A message that we couldn't outright say, so we tucked it in. Could put God's name in there because it was the Persian runners who said and sent it around the Hashkronim, the Meher Machim. Right? We couldn't outright say, you know, Jews. I just happened last night, my wife and I saw this play called Leopoldstadt. I think she was going to see it.
Yeah. Wednesday.
Okay. So I think it's really in its core a Zionistic kind of play. It makes a very good case why we needed a state of Israel. Right? I think I'm going to write a letter to there's one terribly anachronistic thing going on in 1924. Someone's reading the Balfour Declaration, and it says that Majesty's government looks with favor upon the creation of a Jewish state and the traditional Jewish homeland, as long as they don't harm the Palestinians. That word does not appear in the Balfour Declaration. It says the residents, doesn't say Palestinians. The word Palestinians wasn't used until the early 70s. It wasn't even used in 67. I have the hard copies of all the magazines, Newsweek, Time, National Review, The Nation. No one says the word Palestinians in 1967. So to say that in 1924, he's creating it. The word, if you said Palestinian in 1924, that was a Jew. A Jew's passport was stamped Palestinian in 1924. Right? The main newspaper was called the Palestine Post. It turned to Jerusalem in 1948. But anyway, I'm just saying. I think that when you see this play, by the time you see it next week, right? I hope I have it Tuesday, but hopefully you'll think about all of this and say, oh yeah, that's what's going on in Vienna. Just what's going on here. Shenehenu miskudas ha-Hashverosh. Just exchange some names. Alright? Just exchange Haman and Hitler, two ages. Exchange Vienna, where they said the saying, and he says it in the play. Kimi Vienna, some of the scholars are saying that. We don't need Jerusalem anymore. You've got Vienna in Berlin. Right? The closing scene is very chilling. It's a huge family with a lot of people. There are 38 people, I think, altogether. Only three are alive in 1955. And they say, what happened to them? Auschwitz, Auschwitz, Dachau, Auschwitz, Auschwitz, Auschwitz. Okay. One committed suicide, the only one who is 100% not Jewish in the family. Find out that there's only one person in the whole family that has both parents not Jewish. And he committed suicide right after the war. I don't mean to ruin it for you. All right. Okay, so you're going to see that's what this is. And the authors of this book felt that they had to sort of hide that message. But we're going to get it. Right? We've got 127 provinces. I'm not going to darshan that. That's just a nice number. It's Sefer Daniel. It says Dariovish had 123 provinces. These Persian kings were great conquerors. Right? An interesting point. Persian society was very different than Babylonian society. Right? That's going to it's going to be a side issue in chapter 1 between the men and the women. But it will help us understand some of Esther's plots later on. Okay? Babylonians were very refined. They were scientific. They were involved in some of the great wonders of the ancient world. Right? The Babylonians were very artistic, musical. You see from the stories in Sefer Daniel, they loved their music, they loved their art, they loved their gardens, they loved science, and Persians loved beer and drinking. The Persians were boorish compared to the Babylonians. And at this time in history, if there are any remnants of Babylonians, what gender do we think they are?
No.
Males were killed that often. Right? Vashti is a Babylonian name. The women of Bavel are mostly make up whatever Babylonians remain in Persia are women. Right? The men are gone. So do you see that the women, look at what the men do as churls. You guys are real jalopes. You don't deserve us. But what we can do, what can we do? You conquered us. Right? So if you look at chapter 1 on the lens of why Vashti considers this whole thing, I mean, you probably remember hearing on Purim tapes or in Purim stories we learned in school, be careful what you hear. The Gemara says he wanted to come out naked, and she was all too happy to do so, but she grew a terrible tale. You all knew that. How did you know that? What do you think that Medrash is saying?
She literally grew a tail.
Who has tails?
Lizards.
Lizards. Animals. They're behaving like animals. These guys are behaving like animals.
So she grew a tail.
Animals. Or she grew.
It's like a house.
I think when Gemaras say these things, I know when you're 8, you don't question your teacher. You say, okay, you grew a tail, fun. But you have to get to see, because after a while, you grow a little more sophisticated. You're going to say, what does that Gemara mean? You might really need to be taken literally. You're a fool if that's what you think. And the Rambam says so, more than Wolfram. And so does practically everybody. Right? And when you see that Ahasuerus calls her out, see, look at Pasuk Aleph with me. The Burman read it. Oh,
which
parent? Sure,
Aleph.
Okay. Well, she also likes to have a good time, so she's having a festival too. Right? For the women. So, okay, men and women are having separate festivals. That's an interesting thing. Okay? So they have a meeting, what kind of party to have. Right? Because I'm sure she always has a meeting with a lot of people. And this is the conclusion. Pasuk Aleph, read it.
L'havia t'vashdi l'malka l'ifnei ha-melech v'cheter.
Now, hold on a second. When the Gemara says something, even if it's outrageous, like come out naked, there's usually something the Gemara points to in the pasuk that says so. You get it? What you just read?
Yeah.
Which is that he wants you to come out with
nothing on.
How do you know that?
Or with just your crown. Just your crown.
Just the crown. Okay. Come out with the crown. Okay. Laharot ha'amim.
Laharot ha'amim. Ve'ashirim et yafya. Ki tovad mar'eh.
Now, I can understand. You guys probably like it very much if you're on a date with a gorgeous baby and your friends see, wow. Ooh, I don't know. But that's immature. It's immature. If it's the right person for you, just make sure she's beautiful to you. Don't care about whether she's beautiful to your friends. Right? All right, but that's how we are. You can do that with your car, you can do that with your apartment, you can do that with that. Hopefully not, but that's the nature. But for a king? Right, look, you're king over a vast kingdom. Big deal. You got the best looking babe. So what? You got to show her off to your friends? She's not going to go for this. Don't read the next two words.
What's my name? Hamalka.
Next three words.
The Vishti.
Okay, so ma'ein means to
refuse to refuse.
Now, the Malbim, you've heard of the Malbim, Meir Leibishman, he lived in the 19th century. He was a very close reader, even closer than Rashi. Very close reader of text that might just go over your head. Do you see that what Mr. Payman just read refers to Vashti in two different ways?
Yeah. Vashti Hamalka and Hamalka Vashti.
He says, bring out Vashti Hamalka. And Mr. Bluth, what did the next pasuk say? To my aim, ha Malka Vashti. Tell me, what do you think it means? David.
I'm going to be honest. I'm just kind of trying not to read too much into it with my colleague that I've read already.
All right, read what you think someone like the Malbim might say. I mean, it says six words after saying Lahavias Vashti Malka, and then just right afterwards is this main Hamalka Vashti. It's not just chiastic parallelism.
One of them is discussing Vashti as a person, one of them is discussing Vashti as a title. But Vashti is like the figure piece of the government.
Right, so now, I think this may be the moment plugging into something Chazal say, which she was about to tell us.
Which is that Princess Vashti Hamalka, because she's queen because of him. But when it says Hamalka Vashti, it's that, I'm a princess.
Correct. Maybe the Gemara knowing that Vashti is a Babylonian name, not a Persian name, probably, that's where they put in that she's the Nebuchadnezzar's granddaughter. So, but she's Babylonian. And she's basically saying, this is no way for a king to behave. Now, it's interesting that at this time of year, right before Purim, we read a Haftorah that contrasts two kings. Actually, you don't read about the second king, but it's about the failure of a particular king. You know what I'm talking about, right? The Haftorah Parsha Zohar, where Shaul is tasked with eradicating the descendants of Amalek, and he fails. Right? Remember? You know what I'm talking about, right? And he's replaced. The other he tells him, I'm replacing with someone better than you. And that's the Lashon that we're about to see with the replacement of Vashti. So this is, I'm going to introduce you to another concept. The concept is made, it's really made clear, just get this bit down, it's called the art of biblical narrative. Have you heard of it? The art of biblical narrative. It's written by a man named Robert Alter. Still alive. Just came out with a very expensive translation of the Tanakh. It's like $100 for three volumes. Translation of Tanakh. I'm sure this farm sale has it. Robert Alter, his first book was called The Art of Biblical Narrative. And he writes that sometimes a biblical author will present his narrative in a way that is meant to tingle your ear, yeah, in order to recall another narrative that he's aware of. You don't like the idea?
I'm just confused.
Like, the claim is that the replacement of Vashti is going to use terminologies that will remind you of the replacement of Shaul. If this is not Robert Alter's Kiddush, it appears in Chazal. Okay. Esav's reaction when Yaakov took his bracha is practically the exact same words as Mordechai's reaction to Haman's decree.
And you think that's a literary tool and not just
that Esther,
the author's choice?
It's not just coincidence. It's the author of Esther that wants to remind the reader that, you see Yaakov? Do something terrible to your brother. 1,000 years later, his descendant is going to do something to your descendant. And look at the ironies. There's so many ironies in there. Right? What tribe is the only one that won't bow to this man? It's from Binyamin, right? Don't you know that in Parshas Vayishlach, the only son of Yaakov that doesn't bow to Esav is Binyamin? Right? So the Gemara does this and many other examples of this. Right? Why doesn't Binyamin bow to Esau?
He's not born yet.
Okay? So, but that just, the Gemara just says, okay, everyone else already has it in his blood, in his veins, in his DNA, that it's okay to bow to Haman. But not Binyamin, because he never bowed to Esau. Right? Does that make sense to you? But it's part of the irony. And the Gemara builds all case out of some of the book of Esther is happening to us because of what Yaakov did to Esau and 10 other things. Right? Yes.
So which words in particular did you say were the same?
Well, right now, you're just talking about Vashti Amalpin, but it's a Malka Vashti. In other words, that this dichotomy, this change in her reference, is here to tell us that there are deeper things in this story than just what appears on the page. Chapter 1 is a struggle between the past and the present with respect to the men and the women. This will help us explain how Esther manipulated the situation later in the book to behave in a certain way to make her to be anti-Vashti in Ahasuerus' eyes, or to use at her disposal about being rid of Haman.
Sorry, I have it in the division between the genders, but you said Yaakov's words to Esau were very similar to that of
not Yaakov's words to Esau. Yaakov's reaction to Esau. He talks about the law. Esau's reaction, I heard that he lost his bracha. Esau reacts with a line described in the text about how he cried, and Mordechai's reaction to Haman's decree uses the same words. It just changes by Yitzak to by Yizak. The word probably evolved. What is Zahak and Tzak? The same word.
You mean the same word just evolved?
No.
But all the words in the same language.
But you know, Sa'ak and Sa'ak mean the same thing. Just I'm telling you, it's not a coincidence that the same line appears in both places. And Bereshit Rabbah puts them together. Because I'll notice this.
What does Bereshit Rabbah say? It
says, Yaakov, you caused your brother this pain. God keeps the pain you cause other people in a jar. And they will always be taken out. Will always be removed. If you don't, whether especially if it's a widow or an orphan, something's that this is going to be create a whirlwind someday.
Is there a kapara for that? Or is there a way to
kapara can only come with? That's the message of Bereshit Rabbah. By the way, Robert Alter complains. He writes in his introduction that it's my kiddush to look at the Bible this way. He didn't read enough Midrashim. There are plenty of Midrashim to do that. Right? And prayer is about the new approach to biblical narrative he's going to start to take. Horse feathers. The Gemara's in Midrashim do that all the time.
we said on Mahavashti and Vatsamaka.
He says that Vatsama'in Hamalka Vashti is her saying, you don't know how a king should behave. I'm not the queen because you're my husband. I'm royalty. You're not. You were not chosen. Your brother was. And I'm assuming that whatever I told you about Hamolech. I think it's correct to read our story that he was not crowned king. Because you know what? When you take the kingship from someone else, you will live every day of your life, finish my sentence, concerned that someone's going to do the same thing. And add to that the fact that there was an insurrection on his life in the story, right? Big son of Seresh. And you know that he's going to be paranoid. He's not Stalin paranoid or Caligula paranoid, because then he would have killed Haman and Esther. For him, for her inviting him twice to the same party. But he was paranoid enough that he couldn't fall asleep that night, and then we'll read that later. Okay.
Yeah. I feel like there's also something interesting. No, this is the first time that a queen has said that this is not how a king behaves.
And that's the point to it. It's Michal and David.
Right.
Right, it's exactly what's happening here. The author of Esther wants you to think of narratives in Sefer Shmuel.
Right. But then it's interesting to note that the replacement for Vashti is actually one of Shel's descendants.
Perfect. And here too the Bible uses the same words. Re'acha ha-tov mimecha, re'usa ha-tova mimecha. That may be coincidental, but the Gemara didn't say. The Gemara doesn't think so, right? And I think it's good. It's good pshat. There are two parts to any of this kind of discussion in biblical narrative. One, finding the similarities, and then two, a more challenging thing, which I think is what's bothering you here. So what? What do you do with it? What does it mean? Okay. Well, we have to tie this package up, you know, as best we can. I hope we can. No, my plan is to do it before Purim. Okay. But if we do read the storyline of chapter 1 as a have you ever seen this word Shushan Havira? There's only one other city in the whole Tanakh called Bira. Here, Yerushalayim. So by the author of this book referring again and again to Shushan HaBira, he means to tell us that in the eyes of the people, then there's a new Bira. Right? For the Jews in the year 1900, it was Vienna, it was Berlin. Right? Here it's Shushan. By the way, ironically, Maseches Tamid tells us that in Bayis Sheni, there was a furnishing in the Beis Hamikdash called the Shushan HaBira. Are you familiar with that? Look it up. You can see there's something in the Beis Hamikdash called the Shushan HaBira. It was like some kind of an appurtenance. Okay, anyway. You see, you know, in front of the Heichal was something called the Azara, and outside the Azara was the Chatzar HaMikdash. And this keeps referring to the Chatzar of Ahasuerus. Ahasuerus' palace is taking the place of the Beis HaMikdash. His grandeur, Tanakh is using certain words that only are written with regards to the Beis HaMikdash. The colors that are mentioned, the splendor is replacing the Beis HaMikdash. Right?
He literally has kalim from the Beit HaMikdash. Yes. Actual colors from the Beit HaMikdash.
And Lamaisa, we lane with Echatrup, I think I mentioned that last class, when he's using the kalim. Why? What's so sad about Kalim the Kalim Shonim, where he ate Mahus Rabbi Aramela? So what? So the Gemara doesn't tell us to lay that Nechatrop. That's our Minhav. The Gemara just says that these were the Kalim. Now this, I don't think I've seen anywhere. I put it into my Shmos book. Is that it says that there were five types of splendor and six types of officials, Chel, Paras, Umadai, Apartimim, the Surayam Dinos, six officials. They were shown five types of splendor for a parg that lasted 180 days. Gemara doesn't say this, it's Maichab. Okay. In the beginning of Sefer Ezra, and I'm going to take a quick segue for what we're going to do today, hopefully Tuesday if I make it, is that Ezra chapter 1 describes what's on this famous cylinder. You're able to identify it. Here, look at it now. Put it into your heads. You have to get it into your head. Alright? Okay, if you don't get it into your head, it's not going to stay there. Alright? This cylinder, it's this erosion in the middle of it. This is known in Persian historians as the Cyrus cylinder. It describes the permission he granted for the Jews to return to Jerusalem and to rebuild their temple. Okay?
Wait, this is one from the Cyrus scroll?
It's known as the Cyrus cylinder. Now, indeed, he actually allowed many nations to return to their ancestral lands in this cylinder. Israel was just one of them, but he favored Israel. If you want to know historically, why would Cyrus favor Israel? So I'm going to write a series of prophets on the board for you. And there's a little something you need to know about each one to help really get on with what this story is about. Okay? If I could put it into one sentence, Megillas Esther is part of the story for why Vayesheni failed. Vayesheni is supposed to be our final Beis HaMikdash, supposed to be independence, it's supposed to be a return, and it failed. Megillas Esther tells us the story of what. Guys, three or four of you are on your phones right now. Come on, stay with me. This description of the cylinder finds its place in two places in Tanakh. Get to know them. Right? It's very possible that the reason why Cyrus was so favorable to the Jews, and I'm taking one side in the debate, is because Yeshayahu mentions him 200 years before he moved. A prophet named Yeshayahu, who lived at the time of Chizkiyahu, mentions that Koresh will invite you to return to Babel, to Israel, after the exile. There are some commentaries who find that impossible. How could Yeshayahu know that Cyrus is going to allow the Jews back to Israel? The Shabbos is a prophet. He predicted that someone named Cyrus, and maybe later prophets will tell that Cyrus, right? But there's a problem. So Ibn Ezra quotes a commentary in the beginning of Perek Mem, Nachamu Nachamu Ami. His name is Moshe Akomin. And he says, Moshe Akomin thinks that the last 27 chapters of Yeshayahu were written after the exile. Because why would happen? It's not just that Yeshayahu knows the future. How can Yeshayahu speak about an exile that has already happened, calling the people to come back to Israel, to expressing the king, the name of the king who will make it possible, when there were prophets after him, like Yirmiyahu, Tzfanya, who told the Jews, if you repent and change your ways, you won't be in exile. If the people knew this prophecy, they would say, Yirmiyahu, what are you telling us? is already determined.
Our fate is sealed.
And if you get a point? All right, first of all, do you get to where we are right now?
Yeah. Isn't that the nature of prophecy?
So, the answer, I just want to give you a quick answer, is that even though there's a prophecy about an exile in Babel and a call to return, it's not for sure that the people knew this. Right? The people living in Yeshayahu's day, the day he died, did not have a book called Sefer Yeshayahu. You know what I'm saying? The book we have in our hands, called Yeshayahu, might have had the form it takes now, only by it later. Right? You agree? There's only one book of the Tanakh, the whole Tanakh, that we have as a matter of faith, that the day its author died, that book was completed, and that is the Torah. And even there is one opinion in the Tanoim that allows Yahushua to write the last day. Right? But I don't know that the people knew this prophecy that Yeshayahu mentions, Koresh. Right? The last 10 minutes was to convince you why Koresh would favor the Jews. He allowed lots of nations to return to their ancestral lands and to build their temples. Only the Jews he helped. He gave them wood, he gave them animals, he gave them oil, he gave them salt, he gave them money, gold, silver. Yes?
I'm pretty sure the Rambam, when discussing Nabi Shakir, says that if the Nebuas were bad, but this doesn't come true, we're able to trumpet.
Absolutely! And in his Hakdam LaParish HaMishnah, very famously, he uses Yirmiyahu as his proof. He says, because Yirmiyahu actually says that in chapter 29 of his book, when someone said there will only be a Golos for 2 years, this guy's saying 70, he's false, he's wrong, there won't be a 70-year Golos, it'll just be a 2-year Golos. And Yirmiyahu said, Halavai, I hope it'll only be 2 years. And if we return in 2 years, that's not a sign that I'm a liar. Because God was always ready to go back on bad nevuahs. Right? Then how could you ever know if the Nabi is true? Because the Nabi then follows and says, but God doesn't go back on good nevuahs. Because if God could also go back on good nevuahs, how can you ever tell if the Nabi is true or not? Right? When we go 2 years, and we're not coming back, right? Then you'll know he's a liar. And then you'll be able to, good measure, says you won't have to wait that long. He's going to die this year. Okay. His name is Hananiah ben Azur. So Yirmiyahu establishes this rule, correct? So, Hanachinami. You know, maybe this Koresh doesn't happen, but then what's the whole Nebuah for? I think that no Israelite living at that time was aware of this prophecy by Cyrus. Yeshayahu's prophecies were written much later. The form of the Yeshayahu that Yeshayahu has today, nothing within our faith system says that had to be done at the bit when Yeshayahu died. The same might be true for Tehillim. Aren't there Prokim in Tehillim that refer to the destruction of the Beis Hamikdash? Why would David, just building Jerusalem, right, write about its destruction? Al naros bavel shem yishavnu gam bochinu shir malos b'shuv Hashem es shivas tzion ha'inu kecholim? What's that? Shivas tzion. Right?
It seems slightly convenient that nobody knew the prophecy until after the prophecy happened. If it wasn't known back then, we only know about it now.
Daniel went to this Persian king Cyrus and said, let me show you an oracle of my prophets.
Oh, so people didn't know it, so it wasn't widespread in the public.
Yeah, it's not. The Neos didn't know it. Yeah. Yeah, and it's safe to say, you know.
Why do we care about that? That people didn't know?
What if Yirmiyahu tells the people, you know, repent and there won't be a Babylonians will go away, and then, you know, so if Yirmiyahu tells that to the people, then they were aware of these prophecies, and Persian kings calling us to come back. Why would they Yirmiyahu tell them to do it? It's done.
Oh, because we're going to argue that.
Yeah. Okay. So Yeshayahu, by invoking the name Cyrus and Daniel, expressing that, Cyrus, you were born for this. This is your mission. This is why you're going to be remembered. Right? Can I safely say that you have heard the name Cyrus, but before today's class, you have not heard how many Artaxerxes there were. Probably did not know about Cambyses, right? But Cyrus is it? I know people. I know two people named Cyrus. It's a Jewish name, and it's
there's a chorla tov amongst the Jews,
right? In fact, let me read you the last pasuk in the Tanakh.
Is it even in Korach?
Yeah. Let me read you the last pasuk in Tanakh. Get it? Ready? This is the last pasuk. Ko amar Koresh melech paras. Ko amar lachos haaretz nosan li Hashem elokei hashamayim. V'hu pakad olay lithnot lo bayit v'yerushalayim asher v'yehuda. Mi bochem mikol amo Hashem elokav imo v'yohal. Last word in the Bible is Nehemiah. Right? And we're being told by a Gentile. Thus says Koresh, the Lord of the Hebrews, has said, the Israelites has given me dominion over the whole earth. And I invoke his name and exhort his people to go and rebuild the land. Right? Now, historically speaking, this is not the end of the Tanakh, because this very pasuk, almost exactly, appears in the beginning of Ezra. The Gemara says this about Basra. Ezra Yamim is written by Ezra. And then he wrote his own book describing the return, the religious return, Nehemiah being the political return to Israel.
They say Ezra was written after Nehemiah?
Ezra was written by Nehemiah. It's just that it's the first, the very beginning of Ezra. Listen, I'm going to read you a passage, right? Koamar Koresh, second passage in Ezra. Koamar Koresh. He then starts to describe all of the things that Koresh gave them, as it's written in the cylinder. The things they'll need.
Can I interpret what the cylinder says, and does it match up to what's in the Tanakh?
It matches very nicely to the Tanakh. Right? And then Ezra lists the number of kalim he gave that the Babylonians took from the Beis HaMikdash. And that number is... Ezra, Aleph, Yud. Any mathematicians here? Look at the other side.
I assume it lines up.
Gemara said that Ahasuerus spent 180 days showing six different officials five different types of splendor from the Beis HaMikdash. The Gemara used that conveniently. I'm telling it to you. Because Ezra said that there were 5,400 kalim. What were most of those kalim? Some were very big. Some were small. Spoons, shovels, dustpans, ashes. Some were bowls, cups, replacements, most gold and silver. But that's a lot, 5,400. Heck, the Babylonians spent about a month, not 3 weeks, a month. 3 weeks is by a shame. A month pillaging in the Temple Mount after breaking the siege, after breaking through the siege.
How do we know that?
Pillaging. Because it says it's enough that the Babylonians broke through on the 9th of Tammuz. And it says they wiped out, they destroyed the Beis HaMikdash on the 10th of Av. While we fast on the 17th, while we fast on the 9th, is another issue.
Well, just because they were doing their pillaging,
it says it's enough. They didn't just break through and just say, okay, guys, let's have a game of baseball. You know,
they're good at fighting over the city.
Yeah, okay, All right, whatever it is, whether it took a month or a week, they took out, they just emptied everything. Now, the fact is, from Tanakh, we see that 11 years earlier, in 597,
It says they pillaged much of the temple.
Where is that?
When Yechonya was deposed and Tzidkiyahu was appointed.
It says they pillaged.
First Beis Hamikdash, 11 years before the Churban, they exiled the officials, the poor people, the king, Yechonya and his mother, and they appointed a man named Matanya, he changed his name to Tzidkiyahu, and he ruled for 11 years.
And
as a puppet of the Babylonians, under confiscatory taxation, and he rebelled against that. That's why the Babylonians, 11 years later, came, you know, to finish him.
All right, so does it, I hope everyone gets to see the two things I wanted to impress upon you today. One is that I have not fortified yet because it has to do with how Esther used Ahasuerus' mindset with respect to the women and the Bavel. Right? For a man to have to come down with a decree that all men should be in charge of their household. Right? So right? Nonsense. Anybody here watch The Honeymooners with Jackie Gleason? I'm the captain of this ship. And everybody who watches the show, and it's from the 50s, knows that she is, but yes, to proclaim it. Right? So Esther's going to use this. So that's you know, the church. Then the real story is about how the Jews have gotten so comfortable in Persia and that the attempt and the necessary work that we've done to go back to Israel was so what I'm going to do next class, I just told you about Yeshayahu and Koresh. The next class, we're going to have to know how Yirmiyahu, Yechezkel, Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi, Daniel, Ezra, Nehemiah, all relate to our story. Because there is something that you must know regarding every one of these eight Nevi'im. And if the more you don't know about how these eight Nevi'im relate to Esther, the more you'll miss about what Esther's really about. These are all books written around the time of Esther. Every last one of them has something to say, and I'm going to make a bold statement claim next time, whether it's Tuesday or Thursday, is that the author of Esther was aware of these narratives, especially Zechariah.
What? No, I was asking as a nurse because there's some things that I just missed. Like, was it 180? Just five officials, 6 days.
Six officials were shown five articles of splendor for 180 days. That's in the story. The Gemara says those articles of splendor were the if each person, each day, right, is shown five different articles of splendor for 180 days, you're going through 5,400 articles. That's the Gemara's way of saying, is this pshat? I don't know. But sometimes a whole series of drushes reveals an underlying pshat of the story, which is, I keep telling you, that one bira is placing the other bira, replacing the other bira. And if you see Leopoldstadt next week, if you're going, you'll say, oh my goodness, it happened to be an episode. Okay? Have a great day, guys.